Hello and a very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. My name is Simon Brew from Film Stories magazine, and this is a regular podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive library of over 6,000 films brings together cinema from around the globe. Amongst the choices available, well, you can catch up on a bit of David Lynch with Inland Empire and Mulholland Drive. There's some winter warmers such as The Wicker Man and Orphan. What about a few laughs to see in the new year with Alan Partridge, Alpha Papa, The Lavender Hill Mob and Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure? We're going to be doing our very best to explore it all in this podcast. This time, we're celebrating the 4K restoration of Michael Powell's 1960 chilling classic, Peeping Tom, and I'm delighted to welcome Lillian Crawford, freelance film critic, to the podcast. Hello, Lillian. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Now, Lillian, every episode when we bring our guest on, we try and get a little fact about them, and I gather yours has got something to do with the film Monsters, Inc.
Yes, well, the first film I saw in the cinema was Pixar's Monsters, Inc., and I baffled my parents by asking them. They must have to have a massive videotape for a screen as enormous as that.
And what did your parents... I want your parents to have said yes to that.
I think so. I think I had that image in my head for a long time of just a giant VHS tape, especially because the Monsters, Inc. one we had at home was blue. And I used to think that was how films were projected for a long time.
So DVD killed your image of your
it
first...
It really did.
Oh, that's terrible.
Mark, what do you do?
Most of the time I work in a film studio.
On the photographic side, I'll bet.
I hope to be a director very soon.
How exciting. When I came in, were you looking at some films?
Yes.
Of yours?
Yes.
I'd like to see them.
So, Lillian, can you set Peeping Tom up for us? Because, I mean, 1960 was the year it came out, and that's a year where if I ask someone to name a tense psychological horror thriller, they're generally going to come up with something like Psycho. Where did Peeping Tom fit in?
Peeping Tom comes from quite a strange place in Michael Powell's career. This is after his collaboration with screenwriter Emmerich Pressburger, and they were billed for many years as Powell and Pressburger, or The Archers as a company. Peeping Tom comes seemingly to many people out of nowhere. Powell and Pressburger are perhaps best known during the Second World War for their war pictures, and then after the war for their more artistic pictures, things like The Red Shoes, Black Narcissus, Tales of Hoffman, which is Powell's interest in opera. But really, for me, Peeping Tom comes out of something that has existed in all of those previous films, which is Powell's fascination with the macabre and with Freudian psychology. And that sort of comes to a head with Peeping Tom. And because it's to such a great extent and it's so concentrated within this film, it frightens a lot of people, perhaps more so than Psycho does.
Is it safe to be alone with you, I wonder? It might be more fun if it wasn't.
I heard an interview with Martin Scorsese about Peeping Tom just after I'd watched it for the first time. And he talked about his absolute surprise that the guy who made The Red Shoes then made this. And at first he couldn't wrap his head around just around that fact. And then he kind of realised, actually, yeah, that's true. And you've kind of hinted at that there. Can you dig into that a little bit more?
Yes, of course. Well, one of the things that sort of plagues Michael Powell's career as a filmmaker from a critical standpoint is he's often accused of having bad taste. And when The Red Shoes came out, a lot of the critics said that there was a sort of bad taste to the film, particularly at the end of The Red Shoes when Moira Shearer's Victoria Page leaps onto a railway track and is killed by a train. And we see a shot of the blood on her white ballet tights around The Red Shoes themselves. And this image is horrifying at the time and really quite shocking in its depiction of blood. So that moves forward into the critical condemnation of Peeping Tom that comes about. This is a film that is absolutely destroyed by the critics upon release and subsequently ended Michael Powell's career in Britain.
The point you made about the critics, the lead actor in this, Carl Boehm, who plays Mark Lewis, apparently he and Michael Powell went to the first critics press screening of the film. I only just discovered this. And they went up all dressed up to the nines, ready to celebrate, expecting that the response to this was going to be positive. And then the members of the press walked out in disgust and pretty much didn't talk to them on the way out of that screening. So he didn't know this was coming.
No, I don't think he did. And especially because this film really comes out of a lot of discussions that Powell had with Karl Böhm, or Karl-Heinz Böhm, which he's best known as in Austria for making the incredibly popular CC films, which are made by Ernst Marischka from 1955 to 57. He plays Franz Joseph I. So he's a huge romantic figure in Austrian and German cinema. And then when he comes over to Britain, he meets Michael Powell, and they talk about the darkness of their childhoods, of Karl Böhm's father and the way that he treated him. They basically have these sort of therapeutic chats about the difficulty of father-son relationships. And Michael Powell says, I have this script from Leo Marx that you might be interested in. I'd like you to play this character of Mark. Which, of course, he wouldn't necessarily seem like the first person that one would want to cast in this role, because he is a German actor, or rather he has a German accent, which seems quite dissonant with the context of the film in early 1960s London.
Cool down, Mark. Got a question for you. Which magazine sells the most copies?
Those with girls on the front covers and no front covers on the girls.
Exactly. It's just the same with the work you do for me. Look busy.
When he appears in the film for the first time, I mean, there's almost an uneasy innocence to him when we actually see him in view, which I wasn't expecting at all. And again, I've come to this film relatively fresh. I know that you're a huge fan of it. But for me, looking through 2024 eyes, that really took me aback. Was that your reaction?
Well, I hadn't seen the Sissy films prior to watching Peeping Tom. But I suppose if anyone was familiar with him at that point, that is what their image of him would be, as more of a sort of romantic male figure. I suppose there is a certain quietness to him, and I think that that's what Michael Powell and Leo Marx as the screenwriter really want to bring about, is that he is just someone that one might see loitering around Soho in a coat, and no one would think twice if someone had a camera and was filming them. I think it's important to talk a bit about Leo Marx and how he created this screenplay, because he'd spent the Second World War as a cryptographer, working in special communications. But he was raised in the second-hand bookshop Marx & Co. on Charing Cross Road, which was famously used as the setting for the based-on-truth story 84 Charing Cross Road. And he observed a lot of the people who came into the bookshop, which included one of the sex workers who's in the film. It was based directly on a regular customer they would have at the bookshop. So he was observing the kind of people who were moving in and out of these kinds of places in London that Peeping Tom is set in, and using that as material later on. But his relationship with his father, Leo Marx's father, used to put codes in the books that he was selling, and Leo Marx as a child would decode the cryptic clues that were in them. So I think that there's something in common between those books and the cryptography put in them, and the films that are being made by Mark Lewis, Karl Böhm's character, and his own father before him.
Mark, what a beautiful little boy. Who is he?
Me? Of
course it is. Then who took this film?
My father.
What a wonderful idea. You'll be able to show it to your own children. You must have had a bad dream.
It's interesting too that the character of Mark Lewis, time is spent in the film to demonstrate what's created this person. Mm. And I think it was Thelma Schumacher said about Martin Scorsese and Michael Powell, neither of them wanted what you consider a traditional villain in their film. They didn't want a two-dimensional villain. You had to understand why a character was as they are.
Yeah, I would say so. The comparison with Psycho is always going to plague this film, because they are released at the same time, and Psycho does very well and Peeping Tom doesn't, which later on I think it was Hitchcock who claimed that the reason for this was that Hitchcock saw the reaction to Peeping Tom and decided not to have a press screening for Psycho and just released it straight to the public. So you got the public response, which was utter horror, but in a delighted way, rather than the critics who were sort of effectively censors at this point and held themselves up in this country, at least, as sort of the bastions of good taste and judgment, which is what severed Peeping Tom and not Psycho. But Anthony Perkins as Norman Bates is very much a similarly quiet character who's very unsuspecting. But I think that sort of relatability is very important as well, that we understand, or we can at least see through watching Peeping Tom, what the machinations are of his behaviour and where they came from. Pow is fascinated by Freudian psychology at this point, and that's really a driving point of the whole film.
Mark, what a strange thing for your father to photograph.
Switch it off?
No.
One of the most important parts of that, of course, is that when we see the films that Mark's father made when he was growing up as a child, and the child version of Mark is played by Columba Powell, who was Powell's own son, and Powell himself plays A.N. Lewis, the filmmaker. And these aren't films like the ones that Mark is making, which are the final moments of a woman that he kills with the camera. But these are scientific experiments which are founded in shock and fear, and how the filmmaker's son will react to various frightening stimuli. And as a result of that trauma that is placed on him by his father, that is why he is now behaving in the way that he is.
That will do, Mark. Dry your eyes and stop being silly.
Just going back to the point you said about the press screening, about Hitchcock deciding not to have a press screening for Psycho off the back of that, one of the things that Selma Schumacher said relatively recently, I think, is she's criticised the original company who released the film for not really having the courage to go with it, that when the critical backlash came out, the recommendation from her was publish all the bad reviews with a poster saying go make your own mind up. And she thinks Michael Powell would have done that.
I think he probably would have done. I suppose it's difficult because really this is Powell's last hope of sort of making it as an independent director again.
Yeah.
After he and Pressburger had parted ways. He's just immediately prior to this in 1959, he's been in Spain making a ballet film called Honeymoon or Luna de Miel, which is a Spanish version of The Red Shoes, is often described as, with Ludmila Chirina, who was in Red Shoes and Tales of Hoffman, as well as O Rosalinda, which is a 1955 operetta film, which really signaled to Powell and Pressburger that they should stop making these grand opera ballet films because people aren't interested in them anymore. This is the time when we're moving towards the British New Wave, things like Look Back in Anger, John Osborne, that kitchen sink realism is really what people want. So I suppose Peeping Tom comes out of this frustration and this desire to work with a new form of cinema, but he almost goes too far too quickly. And it's not until later in the 60s and into the 70s that really Psycho in particular has inspired an interest in the slasher genre that comes later on.
Lillian, can I ask what your personal reaction was to Peeping Tom first time you saw it? Did you like it straight off?
I was horrified by it. Oh, really? I don't know why. I can't remember when I first watched it. I must have been a teenager.
It wasn't after Monsters, Inc.?
No, it wasn't.
Thank goodness for that.
It was sometime after watching Monsters, Inc. Maybe at the time my interests and taste was perhaps more aligned with a certain childish sensibility. So I think maybe I probably watched it too young, or I watched it without knowing the full context of Powell's career, where this film came from, and what was being interrogated. I think what's really important that the critics of this film didn't seem to understand is that this isn't a film which is endorsing Mark's behaviour in any way. It's interrogating him, and it's very self-reflexive. This is Michael Powell, even though he didn't write the film, I think in the act of filmmaking and in the act of putting this film together, he is reflecting on his own relationship with cinema, with his actors, with what filmmaking is to him, especially of what the camera symbolises and can become. And I think that that element of the film is perhaps missed by those critics and people who still would criticise it today, is that this is almost feels to me like a confessional, that this is someone saying, I understand what my perspective is as a filmmaker, my obsessions, my fears and lusts, I suppose, and creating a film out of those feelings.
Switch it off, Mark! Switch it off!
If we put the film on now, watched it right here, right now, what would your response to it be, do you think? Would it still be that primal horror that you've just described?
I don't think so. I think it has lost a certain impact to me now. I've seen it so many times.
How many so many do you think?
I couldn't possibly count.
Double figures, though.
Probably.
Yeah.
And I suppose once you can anticipate the rhythms of it, there is less of a shock to it. And really, that's part of the point for Mark, is that where he's filming these moments when he's killing these women, so that he can capture that moment and have it and control it and keep hold of it. It goes back to the very early ideas and sort of André Bazin's famous essay on the ontology of the photographic image, which is that to film is to mummify reality or something that's happened, that you almost take a corpse, quite literally in this case, and preserve it in a way that allows you to go back and reuse it, that you have control over it. And that's what we see with Mark in his screening room when he's watching back these films, is that he is taking possession of something that he doesn't understand, which is female sexuality, which he has no understanding of and is frightened of. But in order to make it acceptable to him, he's creating these films, which he then has ownership of.
And you talked just before about Michael Powell and the self-interrogation of his own career as a filmmaker. Should we be looking into the fact that the fictional film in the movie is called The Walls Are Closing In?
I think we have to read into everything that Powell is choosing to. I mean, the biggest one,
Mark,
is that Moira Shearer is in this film
yeah.
as a character who dances, and she performs in front of Mark. Moira Shearer, of course, as I said, was in The Red Shoes when she was in her early 20s, and Powell found her very difficult to work with. She found Powell very difficult to work with. Powell could be quite difficult with his actors at times, and various interviews later on, Powell would reflect on that relationship and say, there's one that I've read in which he basically says that he should have had sex with her and then she would have done what he told her to do, which is effectively this sort of battle between having sex with someone or murdering them is really at the heart of Peeping Tom. So Powell then works with her again in 1951 on The Tales of Hoffman, and then finally for the third time in Peeping Tom. And there's this scene when she's playing an extra in the film that's being made, and she puts on some music and she starts to dance to the music. And we look through the camera that Mark has, and it has this wonderful viewfinder, which is very similar to the viewfinder in a sniper rifle or in a gun. And he's watching her dance and perform in front of the camera to Mark, who is Powell's double in this case. And we really get a sense of what Powell's perspective would have been filming Moira Shearer in The Red Shoes and how he felt about her. And then ultimately moving towards this catharsis, which is to use the leg of the tripod of the camera to pierce her neck.
Mark!
I mean, it's chilling enough that there's basically crosshairs on the lens.
Exactly.
And very early. I mean, that opening shot as well, the close-up of the eye. I mean, can you just talk to that just a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So the opening of the film starts with the famous Archer's logo, which is the archery target and the arrow that hits the bullseye. And then we cut straight into this extreme close-up of Mark's eye, which has been drawn in comparison to Vertigo by Hitchcock, which is released 2 years earlier in 1958. This opening then sees the sex worker out in the street.
It'll be £2.
She's standing in front of a shop window which seems to have these sort of dismembered mannequins. There's lots of legs and it's sort of a woman's body effectively torn apart. And he approaches her and then she leads him up a staircase into her bedroom. And then she starts to realise that he's going to kill her and she starts to scream, which then cuts to the sound of celluloid thrumming for a projector, and this amazing music by Brian Easdale comes in. Easdale was a collaborator with Michael Powell from Black Narcissus, who wrote the Ballet of the Red Shoes, which of course Moira Shearer was later dancing to. So it moves through this sequence, and the scene that it most reminds me of, which is from a later film, is the opening of John Carpenter's Halloween from 1978.
Oh, interesting.
Which has the young Michael Myers as a boy walking into the house and finding his, I think it's his sister, in a bedroom. She starts to realise that he's going to kill her and she screams and he kills her with the knife. And it's not until later on, when he comes back outside the house, that we see who it is, and it's a child. And that's the horror of that opening sequence of Halloween. And like you said earlier about Carl Byrne, he has this sort of quiet quality that even when we first see him fully, when we don't see him from his own perspective, there's a disbelief to the fact that someone who looks like that could commit a crime as horrific as the one we just watched.
I think it's a fascinating canvas. There's so much initial expectation you almost put on him that they seem to play with a little. I do want to just quickly acknowledge the falling pens and the filmmaking ingenuity, which I didn't appreciate at first watching the film, of getting a shot of pens tumbling to the ground, which, as I understand it, they had to make really big pens to make that shot work.
I didn't know that as well.
No, isn't that bizarre? I mean, it's just...
The way that this film is shot is fascinating. It is from a number of different perspectives that, as I say, are then played on by later filmmakers. John Carpenter, Brian De Palma uses it a lot. Yeah. The film Body Double from 1984 is a direct sort of homage to this film. And there's a film from 2012 that he made called Passion, which features a wonderful sequence, which is clearly indebted to Palin Pressburger, in which a ballet dancer is performing to Debussy's Afternoon of a Faun on one side of the image in split screen, with a murderer going up a staircase to murder Rachel McAdams' character. And the sort of connection between the two images is absolutely fascinating. So they're really creating something in this film which hasn't been done before. As I say, there are these comparisons to Hitchcock's films, and there are more, many more, not least the fact that Anna Massey is in both this film and in Hitchcock's Frenzy from 1972. I think it is fascinating how they created a sort of dialectic of imagery, really, through the camera, which hasn't been explored prior to this point.
This is so many things, but above all, it's so completely unexpected.
And rounding Peeping Tom off for us, I mean, you said at the start that this was a film that should have been lauded, but effectively brought Michael Powell's career to a shuddering stop. Can you just explain what happened?
So after the film comes out, there's these, it's almost like the critics in the UK were trying to outdo each other for just how extreme they could be in their review. He's compared to the Marquis de Sade. Derek Hill in the Tribune wrote, "The only really satisfactory way to dispose of Peeping Tom would be to shovel it up and flush it swiftly down the nearest sewer."
Four stars, right?
Exactly. Yeah. This is the lengths that people were going to in their criticism to try to end Michael Powell's career by saying that he had created something so morally objectionable. So Michael Powell's career then is effectively ended because he won't get funding to make films in the UK.
Or Europe either, was it? He
works, so he is able to continue working in much the same way as filmmakers who have been exiled from America or Britain, people like Woody Allen or Roman Polanski, can still get funding from their films in other countries. Although, of course, that's more moral objection to the filmmaker themselves rather than to the content of their filmmaking, as it was in this case. But I suppose this is effectively a form of cancellation, really, for him in Britain and in America. He makes a film version of Bartok's opera, Bluebeard's Castle, in Germany in 1963. The production designer who designed films like The Red Shoes and Tales of Hoffman, Hein Heckroff, who was working at the Frankfurt Opera in Germany at this point, invited him over to Germany to make this incredible film.
Yeah.
And Bluebeard's Castle has a lot in common with Peeping Tom. It's about a man who has this sort of inner sanctum, or these celluloid corpses, effectively, in the case of Peeping Tom, these women that he's murdered. And Anna Massey as Helen is effectively attempting to delve deeper into the castle, or in the case of the Bluebeard fairy tale, but in order to get closer to him. And the terror of allowing this woman, who I think Mark genuinely has feelings for, but doesn't know how to work with them in the same way that Bluebeard does with his wife Judith when she comes to the castle. But eventually she discovers the corpses, and in the fairy tale, in Bluebeard, it's the case that she must also die, whereas in Peeping Tom, it's that he has to kill himself. So Powell then also then goes to work in Australia and makes films like Age of Consent and They're a Weird Mob, which is one of the most baffling films I've ever seen.
As we sit now, Peeping Tom has a reputation that perhaps it should have got to about 40 years previous. Martin Scorsese paid to have it remastered and put into the New York Film Festival. It's found its new audience. Is it a case of it's about time?
Oh, absolutely. I interviewed Thelma Schumacher when she came over here for the Pan and Pressburger retrospective, and with the release of this new restoration, it's been talked about a lot again over the past few months. And I think it's remarkable how much of horror cinema comes from Powell and Pressburger, and not just Peeping Tom, as I said. These filmmakers who we associate with a certain heightened sensibility and very sort of beautiful cinema are so integral to the slasher genre, to horror, and to filmmakers that are continuing to make films like that today.
Before we wrap things up, Lillian, one thing we also ask of our guests is just to delve into the Studio Canal catalogue for us and see if you can serve up a double bill. So what have you picked?
I've chosen two Ealing films, other than my interest in Pan and Pressburger. Ealing is my principal interest in British cinema. And I've chosen the 1950 film Dance Hall by Charles Crichton, which is about four factory workers who like to go out to a local dance hall every week. And it's just a really beautiful celebration of young people in the early 50s. And it's shot by Douglas Slocum, who's an absolutely right. incredible cinematographer. And it really captures the sort of jazzy dance feel of that era.
I'm positively through with men. I was only interested in you because you were fond of dancing. So for goodness sake, don't go getting any ideas into your head. I mean, I might have been interested in you once, but after the way Jack, Fred treats me, especially Fred, why, it's enough to put a girl off men for life.
The other one is the 1952 film Mandy by Alexander McKendrick, which again is shot by Slocum and is about a deaf girl and her parents who take her to a specialist school for the deaf, and she learns how to interpret sign language and how to verbalize words.
That school, I saw children younger than Mandy and deaf like her that could speak. They'll grow up to have some place in the world. They'll get a chance to live like normal people, not shut up like Mandy is.
It's just one of the most beautiful films that I've ever seen, and I find it particularly fascinating. A lot of my work is about autism and film, and I find it very useful as a film for sort of articulating how film can interact with disability. But these are two films that are little seen. Few people are aware of them. People tend to know the bigger Ealing comedies. So I thought I'd shout out a couple of my favourite ones that are thankfully available on DVD.
Lillian Crawford, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can find Mandy and Dance Hall on DVD and that spectacular 4K restoration of Michael Powell's Peeping Tom is available now on UHD, Blu-ray and DVD. Now it's time for our regular news update from the world of Studio Canal. Back to Black, the film telling the story of the iconic Amy Winehouse, is confirmed for cinema release in the UK on April the 12th. Marissa Abella is taking on the role of Winehouse, with Jack O'Connell, Eddie Marsan and Leslie Manville also in the cast. Sam Taylor-Johnson directs from a script by Matt Greenhalgh, and the pair are no strangers to music biopics, having first worked together on the story of John Lennon's early years, Nowhere Boy, back in 2009. A fresh trailer for Back to Black is out now, and here's a taster.
I want people to hear my voice. And just forget their troubles for 5 minutes.
Do you know what girl power means to me? Sarah Vaughan, Lauryn Hill. You need to know this. I ain't no Spice Girl.
Next up, a film we've mentioned on this podcast before. You're going to get a lot of acting wattage for your money in the incoming Wicked Little Letters, a black comedy based on events that actually happened, with copious amounts of potty mouth language in it.
The mystery of the obscene little Hampton letters is causing widespread distress across the nation.
Olivia Colman and Jesse Buckley take the lead in Thea Sharrock's film of a small town gripped by poison pen letters and the mystery of who's behind them.
Why would I send a letter when I can just say it?
I'll get you in the vault, sir!
She's heinous.
You want in the nose?
Throw in Timothy Spall, Anjana Vasan and Hugh Skinner, and it's an early 2024 cinema treat that's already been getting strong reviews. Wicked Little Letters opens on February the 23rd.
You look like Queen Victoria shoved.
You daft old...
I'll be back soon with the next episode of Studio Canal Presents. Until then, to get all the news on Studio Canal as it happens, and to find out more about the ITVX, Apple TV and Prime Video channels, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on X, Instagram and TikTok. For now, I'm off to make myself a little home movie. Just do a runner if you see me coming towards you with a camera. Ta-ta for now.